Hello, everyone. Okay, we're going to go into the penultimate session for today. This is kind of the headline panel. With all due respect to all the other panels today, which have been excellent. But right, everyone at the bar, get your drink. Come and feel free to heckle. And let's get stuck in, because this panel, developing the infrastructure of Scotland's music industry, could be a lively topic. It's one that we could discuss all day and could well get contentious. So let's take this apart and put it back together again. In a moment, I will ask our panelists to properly introduce themselves, because I'm very pleased to be joined by Alan, Jeff, Rachel and Neil here. And my name is Dougal Perman. I do lots of things, but I'm here in the capacity of chair of the Scottish Music Industry Association, a trade body and kind of think and do tank, if you like, for development of music business interests in Scotland. And it's our position, it's the SMIA's position, that Scotland has an abundance of creative talent, and that's particularly true in the music industry. And as a nation, we shouldn't be complacent about nurturing that musical talent. I was very interested in this morning's keynote, where Jed talked about the Brit School and made what I see as a statement, I think one could take as a statement of intent to bring the Brit School to Scotland. And I think we should take him up on that. I went to a school in Edinburgh that has a specialist music school, Edinburgh Music School, attached to it, which was recently under threat by the local authority to be essentially broken up and redistributed. But I think you could take that as being disbanded and dissolved through budget constraints. Thankfully, that has been overturned, because that would have been a massive loss to the nurturing of musical talent through state education. But we can't be complacent about that, and we mustn't ever take our eyes off that. But currently we have a tremendous asset in the creative talent that is evidenced here. We've got a thriving live scene. We have a potentially vibrant music business. But what state is it in? What do we lack in terms of business talent? And what can we do to plug the gaps that we may have and develop more infrastructure? And talent is rich all over Scotland, but Glasgow is the music hub of and the centre of the music industry endeavour, also the second city of music in the UK outside of London, and a major contributor to live music spending. There's a music tourism development project that we've been researching and strategising on behalf of Scottish Enterprise and Glasgow Life. And we valued Glasgow's live music economy at £160 million a year, which is actually a relatively conservative estimate. That's about 4% of the UK's live music economy, from a city with far less than 2% of the UK's population, when you take Greater Glasgow into account. But music business is more than just the live scene, of course, and we'll explore all of these points. And we're going to ask, how can Scotland capitalise on creative music output, especially in music? And what can we do to develop music industry infrastructure in Scotland for the benefit of all? And what would that do economically and culturally? But before we get into all of this, I'd like to ask the panel if you would all introduce yourselves briefly, please, and then just a few words say, what do you think about the health of Scottish music business right now? Not the music scene or scenes, but music business. Alan, I'll plunge you in at the deep end first. Who are you and what do you think of that?
Okay, so I'm Alan Morrison, Head of Music at Creative Scotland. So funding all sorts of things, from recording to tours, festivals, venues. And that's just not just the music side of it. I've got obviously the colleagues who are doing the same sort of things across theatre, visual arts, literature, everything. Giving out government money, giving out lottery money, which is one of the things that's on a major decline at the moment. In terms of infrastructure, there's obviously a kind of, as I say, capital type venue infrastructure that we've supported for years. There's obviously the musicians themselves from the days of Scottish Arts Council through to Creative Scotland now that we will develop what they're doing. Historically, probably it's what we're talking about here, the infrastructure that we haven't been funding so much, the talent behind the talent.
Mm.
The lawyers, the agents, the managers, and now if we're wanting to keep more of the musicians here and crucially keep the income up here and not mostly draining south, then we're probably going to have to start looking at how through the routes that we have we start supporting that talent behind the talent.
Absolutely, thank you. Jeff.
Sound sat on my mic there. So can you all hear us okay? So there's quite a lot of background noise out there. So can you hear us at the back? Can you hear us clearly yet? Yeah, you can. Okay. All right. It's just I couldn't work out whether you could or not. So my name's Jeff Ellis. I run a company called DF Concerts based in Glasgow. And we do concerts, everything from like 50 people up to 50,000 at Hampden. We create music festivals. We ran Tea in the Park for 23 years, I think it was. We created a Transmit Festival last year. We run Glasgow Summer Sessions. So we work at all levels. We own King Tut's Wah Wah Hut in Glasgow as well. So we're used to working with bands who are unsigned on a local level, giving them a leg up where we can. And we're used to working with some of the biggest artists in the world, like, you know, the Eagles, AC/DC, Calvin Harris, Rihanna, Beyonce, Robbie Williams, Radiohead, Coldplay, all across the spectrum and across all musical genres. So I would say, I think the live industry is very healthy, certainly in Scotland. I think Scotland punches above its weight. We've got, maybe a tenth of the population of the UK, but we do a lot better in terms of the financial contribution from concerts and the impact that makes on tourism. And that can be checked with PRS's figures, where the returns are higher in Scotland, generally per capita, than most regions in England are. So it is a healthy live music scene. People like going to gigs, particularly in Glasgow. Glasgow's got a plethora of venues. But, you know, when we started Tea in the Park back in 1994, there's only really Reading Festival and Glastonbury in the UK. Now there's loads of outdoor festivals in Scotland alone. So, you know, the market has grown, it's expanded, and it is pretty healthy. But that's not to say that it's infallible, and it's very easy to, if we don't take care of it, to kind of kill the golden goose. And, you know, and that can be by not protecting venues, by, you know, not supporting the development of artists. You know, it's record companies aren't the size that they used to be. They don't make the money that they used to. It's a lot harder for record companies to invest in, you know, major labels anyway, to invest in bands with the kind of money that they used to back in the 1980s and 1990s. So there's lots of challenges out there. But, I think it's, you know, we're sitting in a good position, but it's, you know, we need to protect that position and not be complacent about it.
Thank you. Rachel.
So good afternoon, everybody. I'm Rachel Brown, and I'm the Chief Exec of Cultural Enterprise Office, which we've been available for sessions. I was going to say the sesh, over at the crates most of the day. So as I was given the brief by Dougal explicitly to be disruptive this afternoon, and I'm completely and utterly disappointed, because Alan and Jeff have said absolutely nothing I don't agree with so far. So this is going to get bit dull, bit quick. So we're going to look to you to help noise it up ever so slightly. My view on where we're at in terms of music industry and music business is We're not in that great a position, to be honest. And the reason I say that, not to contradict what I've just said, but because we haven't developed the talent behind the talent. And we need to understand why that is. We need to understand why people don't want to be in those roles or act or understand what it could be to be in those roles. But more importantly, we need to understand the breadth of opportunity across the country. And some of that is really about how we treat ourselves and collaborate with ourselves. I do a lot of things like this, and very often people say, it's all right in Glasgow, we didn't get that in Dundee. And you're like, oh my God, and they go, it's all right for Edinburgh, we didn't get that in Glasgow. And you're like, really? Can we stop the town bickering across the country? The fundamental point that we need to all grasp and get on the bus with is that Glasgow is a global gateway. And let's focus on how we make Glasgow more of a global gateway by developing the talent behind the talent so that we don't lose that down south and for people naturally think that they have to jump to London to make any use of anything that's going on. A shameless plug for Culture at Prize Office, we are absolutely the best kept secret in Scotia. When I came and joined the organisation a year ago, there was like four folk knew about us. That's a complete lie. I just remembered Alan's here. As our predominant funder, we were overrun with people wanting to use our services. But now we're starting to see an influx of people who really want to engage and really understand what it means to be part of the creative industries. A big, big thing that we also have to address partly throughout the course of 2 or 3 years is that people will have portfolio careers, and that's a fantastic thing. People are self-employed because they want to be self-employed, not because they can't get a job. And we need to think really strategically about the music business within all of that. What does a portfolio career look like? So how do we continue to develop the talent behind the talent to use a global gateway such as Glasgow to make sure that we don't lose our global position that we already have?
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Assertive and provocative and valuable, although a liberal interpretation of brief. Neil.
Hi, everybody. My name is Neil Semple. I head up the creative content team in the UK Department for International Trade. So that's leading the expert team at for film, TV, video games, publishing, and music. In terms of my own personal view, in terms of the infrastructure for music, to me, it starts from the ability of people to create. And actually, guys, you need places to play. I think venues are critically important. I think the authorities in Scotland, the local authorities, need to keep the venues open. In London, a place I visit a lot, there's been a lot of venues have closed. I think, is it 25% over the past 10 years? And it's been a big campaign to keep those venues open. So I think that's very, very important. I also agree about the point about the talent behind the talent. And I think what's important about this event and other events we go to internationally, and I'll talk about the international stuff a bit later on, is the importance of networks and sharing knowledge. Every time I come to a music event, I go away with a piece of knowledge, a contact I've not known before. And I think it's incredibly important that people actually share knowledge, share information about, you know, how to get ahead in this business. It's incredibly tough. People need a lot of resilience. It's great that people like Jeff and others have created the ability, for, the venues for people to play and to give people the opportunity to share the music. I know that streaming is critically important and people talk about digital a lot, but I still think the ability for people to actually go out and experience music is very, very important. So I think a lot of it starts from the venue infrastructure, but also the ability of Scotland to build up a sustainable music sector where perhaps we can have one or two sort of label services companies, some more management companies, or more of the infrastructure actually staying in Scotland. And I think it needs all the authorities to work together to make that happen.
Thank you. You touched on it there, but factors like digital diversification right through to property prices have caused many UK HQs of industry operations to move out of London. So a lot of the music ones have gone to Brighton, for example, media to Manchester. But to what extent do you think the music industry is still, most of it is still rooted in London, and how does that affect us in Glasgow? Jeff?
Well, I think the record labels, the major record labels are in London, so that's kind of a big driver, and all the main music agencies, if they're not in LA, they're in London. So and all the big American agencies now have London offices as well. So
in terms of talent agencies,
yeah. You know, your Willie Morris's CCA and everything. I don't know whether that will necessarily change, because that tends to be the European offices as well. Those agents will book all of the world except North America. So they will do that out of London, and London becomes a hub for them, because, you know, they're dealing with French promoters, they're dealing with the record labels, dealing with its French office, that the main office, you know, for Europe and the rest of the world is London. So I think that's why, you know, London will always be the centre, certainly the recorded industry. And whilst live agents are working out of London, it's because, you know, historically they're linked with, you know, having weekly meetings with product managers, A&R guys, marketing teams, everything else. You know, it was a necessity to all be in London. As you say, it's changing a bit. 13 artists moved to Brighton. That's probably the biggest agency to move outside of London, but still has a London office as well. So from the live side of things, it's different. I mean, I moved to Scotland from London 25 years ago, so I went the opposite way. But the necessity of being in London isn't there that it used to be. But is it all going to change? Is everybody going to uproot and move six? And, you know, I'm not sure that'll happen, because London is, you know, the European capital as far as, you know, the music industry is concerned.
Would it make much difference to you as a promoter if some of those key organisations weren't in London, if we had more of it in Scotland?
Now that all business is done by email, it probably wouldn't. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it would have made a big difference, because I was constantly going down to London to go and meet agents. Now, you know, I'll see agents at gigs, but, you know, we do everything. I mean, most businesses, you know, historically is done over the phone, but now with email, you don't need that, you know. You know, and you do video conferencing and everything else. So I'm not sure it would have that. I mean, yes, doing a face-to-face is always better. You know, there's nothing like having a beer or a coffee with an agent to develop a relationship. But you know, I don't think we've been hampered with, you know, being an hour and 15 minutes on a flight away from London.
Okay, thank you. Neil, what have you observed from your time away from Scotland and looking back at it? And then in terms of UK government infrastructure, does it matter, do you think, to us that so much is still based in London?
I think from a UK perspective, it doesn't. Successive governments have always tried hard to create policies to create infrastructure outside London. The issue of creative, and it applies to music and film and TV, is that London is such a creative powerhouse, and in terms of digital as well. And so you have particularly, you know, young people just gravitate towards London, because that's where the careers are, that's where the jobs are. I think Jeff is right. I mean, I think in terms of music promotion, there was a session earlier about sync, you know, the music publishers, all those decisions with the big media companies, it's very much driven from London. But I would hope in the digital age where, you know, people can create their own music, get it on a platform to share across the world, that model over time can start to change, and that we can have more independent labels. You know, you look at the grime scene, for example, what they're doing now with self-publishing, with, you know, creating their own labels, having sort of service deals through sort of label services. They're trying to disrupt the music industry to a certain extent. So if you try and build that sort of grime model and perhaps try and create a more independent way, even though a lot of them are actually working with major labels, I think that's quite an interesting concept. Having lived in London for 17, 18 years, yes, when I was living there in the 80s and 90s, it was very much was the centre of the music scene. And as I said earlier, there were far more music venues than there is now. But I think the UK, I think possibly because a lot of the growth of the festivals across the UK, there's some very strong regional scenes across the UK. And so I think that, you know, they need to be encouraged. But we come back to the central point. Until you actually have the talent behind the talent that can sort of sustain an industry within centres like Glasgow and Edinburgh and other parts of Scotland, it's going to be difficult to actually, you know, grow an industry here. Obviously, London's a global city. We really should not compare ourselves with London. We should compare ourselves with other cities in Britain. So I would say that let's stop talking about London as much and talk about other parts of the UK.
Thank you. No, good point. And also, I don't know if this needs clarification, but when we're talking about the talent behind the talent, that's a reference to the business talent that supports the creative talent. Management is just one example of that. Rachel, to start with, how do you think creative bodies, private businesses, industry organisations, third sector, not-for-profit things, and public agencies, how can those three unholy different areas work together for mutual benefit?
Well,
because you're kind of in the middle of all of that.
I'm always in the middle of something. I think there's certainly something around collaboration that has to be genuine and authentic, and we've not really broken that yet. We still work separately in far too many areas, and we don't come together on the things that really matter. So an interesting point, you know, as Neil just said, around London being a global city and actually looking in and around what else is going on in the UK. In terms of tech and digital, Edinburgh leads the way in the UK, and it has the biggest thriving angel investment scene out with London. So there's something about it's working in other areas and other industries, and we always look at that as a separate entity, but actually digital covers a whole range of different things, and it disrupts across a huge curve. So I think there's something about us understanding how to collaborate, and the real challenge with that is the pace that everybody operates at. So the public sector, the private sector, and the third sector, for want of a better phrase, all operate at very, very different speeds. And they all choose to operate at different speeds because they have different responsibilities at different times. And we don't spend enough time understanding how that can work from an infrastructure perspective to make sure that things don't get held up, or to make sure that if we need to move quickly, we can, because there's trust and development there that actually might be more appropriate for an organisation like ours to move quickly on something, and actually for something like Create Scotland, for example, to take the time and the effort to develop the bits that go behind that. And until we can get to those areas of trust and those areas of development, it'll be very difficult for us to see really big traction for the talent behind the talent. And a good example of this is within the social enterprise sector, which some of you may or may not know, around social business for good. 10 years ago, there was a strategy created around the social enterprise sector, which is essentially a mindset and a business model to say, we're going to force collaboration. We're going to get everybody in the room, from the tourist board to the education establishments, a whole range of partners, and we're going to force that collaboration in order to demonstrate how this new business model can affect what's going on within our country. And that, by and large, really worked, because it took about 3 or 4 years for people to really understand what was going on. But the upshot of that was there's more investment from a variety of different sources, which is something that's really lacking in the music industry and the music business industry. And we need to really, again, we need to really unpick that, because we get the two things confused and we get the reasons for investment confused. And it really helped bring new talent and keep talent into the industry. And I think we should look out with what's going on within the music business and the music industry to what's already been successful in other areas of Scotland, and see what we can collaborate with, see what we can draw from. Because we tend to be alone. Everybody says this is really hard, I'm on my own. And that's not necessarily the case. We're already doing really good stuff in a wider wider policy context, in a wider sector context, and in a wider infrastructure context. We don't need to start or reinvent the wheel.
Thank you. Alan, what's your perspective on that? I mean, how does a public sector agency have meaningfully interact with business for, you know, to try and achieve this economic prosperity as well as cultural growth?
Yeah, I think, I mean, quite often, I think Creative Scotland is seen as off on its own, and it's the one place you can go to and get all your money from. And as those money routes become less for us, you know, we need to partner up better. I would love to see more business money coming into the sector.
In terms of public-private partnership?
Yes. And because we're just simply not going to have the money in the public sector anymore to be able to do what we've done historically. And we need to find other bodies that plug those gaps. I mean, I've been in this job since a year past June. One of the best things that has happened in that, you're talking about people who are based down in London and moving about, one of the best things I think that's happened for the sector is Help Musicians UK opening an office up in Scotland. That presence that they've had at almost every event I come to now up here is really helping, because we can find ways that we can do things that they can't do, they can do things that we can't do. I can think of one specific example, because Claire Javot, who was here chairing earlier, Claire started fairly recently in this job as well. When we had our first phone meetup, we're just talking about the different funds she had, different funds Creative Scotland had. A few weeks later, after that conversation, there was a singer-songwriter, Carla Easton, who got in touch with us saying she had an opportunity to do the songwriting workshop at Banff. It was going to happen in less than the 2 months that our funding deadlines are. I remembered Claire had mentioned a certain bursary, sent Carla to that, it happened. There you go. We managed through a phone call partnership just to set something up that physically benefited someone who now has gone off and got money from PRS to go and play at Pop Montreal and then record through us her next solo album there. So things start to connect up when we're able to meet at things like this.
And you're able to share information and have that exchange.
And admit the things that you can't do from your organisations and find out where other people's strengths are and pull that together. And that might not just be through funding, it might just be through any kind of talent and any kind of skills that people are bringing to things.
And then that, in terms of joining up with private sector, I mean, take it in the example you gave of Carla, like take a singer-songwriter like Carla Easton, Teen Canteen, bands doing well. Then you could look at how the live scene supporting that, how venues and promoters are interacting. And then is there much information exchanged, do you think, Jeff, with you and the public sector and the government?
Not really. And I think everybody would agree.
Could there be more?
There could be more. And I think that you know, I think everybody would say that. And there's probably a willingness to do that. I think, you know, with anything, and if you take the public sector out of it for a minute, if you're talking about an album release or you know, product release for a campaign, and you were looking at doing some live stuff, you know, you'd look at the whole strategy and what the plan was, because you don't just go out. We'll invest in a key slot on a major music festival for this artist, without knowing that the label are going to be behind it, that Spotify are into it, that radio's into it, if it's applicable to radio, you know, particularly obviously, you know, Radio 1 or whatever. So you kind of, you know, you look at the strategy, you look at the people involved, and you make decisions collectively. That's the right play, you know, that's where we should be exposed. So the same thing comes in with, you know, Alan's example there, with, you know, working with you know, public sector kind of support. You know, again, there should be, you know, the dots should be kind of joined, and it all become part of a, well, you know, what is the next step? And I think, I know it's just, you know, Sam Coyle in the audience, something he used to say to bands when they're applying to go to South by Southwest was, don't just go because, you know, we'd like to get exposure in the States. Wait until you've got something to actually, you know, be able to promote.
You know, until you're market ready.
You know, and it's like bands who say, right, you know, if an agent phones and say, we want to get on a festival bill, you know, is there any point in them doing it? Because you're not going to book them again the following year, and there might be a need for them to do it the following year. So I think when it comes to these discussions, it's kind of getting all the ducks in a row, really, and going, well, you know, how do we exploit that, and how do we make that beneficial to, and if we're looking at the talent, at the artist being the talent in the centre, and then the talented people around them, you know, be that, you know, from public sector support, managers, you know, labels, whatever, you know, everyone, you know, kind of having a bit of a plan, and really that's, you know, we should communicate more, and we should talk more, and probably, you know, it's because people probably think in silos quite naturally, because people will think, well, can I get some funding from Creative Scotland, and then maybe not thinking, but what's the next plan, and maybe put that plan into place and then go and see Creative Scotland, and you might be able to get a bit more support behind it, because it's like, well, here's plan A, or here's step one, then step two is coming up there, we've got this support, if we get that, then we've got this support lined up here, and suddenly you've got a plan in front of you that makes a lot of sense strategically.
I mean, I don't know, it frustrates the hell out of me, so it must for everyone else, because I actually work there. But there is a problem with public money and the sense that something actually might make a profit out of it if you give it any money. So it's often hard for, like, the commercial live music sector or something to come to us for money, because it's seen as commercial and not something that's that... supported subsidised sector.
Yeah, so at the same time, there's this drive to commercialise cultural activity.
Yeah, how do we fund things to be sustainable, but then where's the grey area that, oh, it's actually becoming commercial and profitable, so it's not something we can fund. You know, that is one of many catch-22 situations I find myself in every week. And one of the things that we've been trying to do with the music team and the creative industries team at Creative Scotland is not have us as two separate entities working in our own bubbles, because to me it always seemed that the music team were taking usually particular, you know, artists up to a certain level of career development, and the creative industry team were supposed to be doing a similar thing across the sector, but there was a big bridge from what you do with individuals to what was going over there, and organisations were missing in the middle, and all of the things that we are talking about the kind of businesses of publishers or sync or any of that kind of stuff was just falling into that big gap. So we're having these internal conversations, but I think there's a massive thing about public money in general, about how far it can go into commercial sectors.
I think there's it also stems back to the let's call it prejudice, because it is historical prejudice that rock and roll, and by rock and roll I also mean dance music, you know, I'm not just being genre specific, that rock and roll is a bit vulgar, it's you know, it's popular, so therefore it's populist, therefore it's not worthy, it's not high art, and, you know, public money should be going to high art, and that's, you know, it's bollocks really, but it's, you know, and I don't think it's as bad as it was 10, 15, 20 years ago in terms of that outlook. But I still think that there's some people who are going to be making decisions somewhere along the line, going, yeah, there's a big commercial industry. Artists make loads of money. You know, rock and roll artists make loads of money, don't they? And that's a perception. Whereas if you're in the, you know, the more the cold high arts, you know, opera, classical music, or whatever, there's probably a bit of a different outlook. Oh, they need support, or they're going to die out. Well, guess what? You know, rock and roll can die out if it doesn't have the support as well. You know.
Well, it's certainly true that once an act has made it to a certain level, then they can make a lot of money. They can make lots of money through gigs, through streaming, through licensing, but if they don't ever have any help to get there, they'll never be in that position. And an opera isn't financially viable in a standalone position, but it is very commercially attractive to private patronage, just as it is worthy of public subsidies. So I think, you know, you have to be very careful about how you categorize the value of art. And one of the things that's really inspired me, particularly in the music tourism development, is how the German government has protected Birkin as a site of cultural heritage and importance, which essentially values techno alongside the Berlin Philharmonic. And that is right and just and absolutely true. Sorry, Rachel, you were going
to
say?
I just wanted to pick up on the point around public money and the transparency of public money, because we do have lots of examples of where Scotland in across a whole range of different sectors invests in organisations and businesses that make profit and develop that profit, and the public money's gone in purposely to aid that profit. And so there needs to be a change in how we think about the investment, to use that word, in the creative industries or a specific sector, a subset within the creative industries. So if you look at the way that we understand and report and manage public money, every single person in this room would agree that transparency of public money to be spent well is what we should all be striving for. And I think there are new ways and different ways to be able to do that. And some of the challenges and some of the areas are around what we want to attribute those outcomes to be, or what do we want to see that public money for. And we are still quite restrictive across lots of areas of what that needs to look like. And another example from Berlin, where there's no criteria for some of the public money for the creative industries. It's just going in because if you say you're going to do that, and here's your business plan and your strategic plan to do it, that's what you're going to say, that's what you're going to deliver. And actually, it's not about saying we've got a cap of 10 grand and these are the criteria, this is what we're going to give you for. It's about saying, what do you need to make successful, and who else is with you in the journey? So I think there's other ways of us to think about how to be transparent with public money that's already going on across Europe. And that's actually already going on in Scotland. We do this across other areas in Scotland as well.
Yeah, I mean, to pick up the point, Jeff made a reference to South by Southwest, which will enable me to speak a little bit about our international support from DIT. I mean, the two sort of grant schemes we contribute to, the main one is the Music Export Growth Scheme, which is delivered through BPI, and Chris Tams from BPI did a session this afternoon on Med support. So far, we've had 10 funding rounds where we've given over £2 million to 150 artists. The artists have got to be, you know, sort of SME, definition of SME. People apply through their management companies. And in terms of how that process is run, yes, we actually do look at the fact that an art is, you know, established in a territory, normally the UK, they've got a strong management team behind them, they've got a good live campaign that they want support from government. And when the BPI board, or the board of music experts run by BPI, makes the decisions on meds, all that is taken into account. And as Scottish artists like Jan Fathers and five or six others have benefited from med support over the 10 funding rounds over the past 3 years. DIT also put money into the PRS Foundation for Music administered International Showcase Fund, as do, I think, Creative Scotland, Alan. Again, that's a very good scheme for particularly artists that are focused on specific genres, whether it's folk, whether it's Americana, whether it's jazz. And I think increasingly the urban genres, I mean, the music story of 2017 has been grime. I think increasingly we'll see, you know, grime artists being supported in various ways as well. And one final point I would like to make about, ultimately, music is about making money, monetizing your rights. Let's give one example of where there's opportunities outside Europe, outside the States. In September, DIT, along with BPI and Music Publishers Association, supported a mission to South Korea. Now, in South Korea, there's a huge K-pop scene, and the K-pop is hugely popular in the whole of Southeast Asia. Now, the K-pop artists want to work with British writers, they want to work with British producers. So there was a whole lot of opportunity outside Europe for the UK music industry in Scotland to exploit. But again, in terms of putting the right people in front of those opportunities, government's not going to choose those people. We're going to work with our music partners and the various trade bodies, BPI, MPA, AIM on the independent side, PRS Foundation for Music and others, and we'll decide, you know, who are going to be the most appropriate UK artists that can really make a breakthrough into this particular market. I think it should work better, things could always improve, But I think particularly on the international side, we've got a very strong record of working in partnership with all the different agencies. And that's what I would like to encourage a lot more to make sure that we're maximising the benefit for the whole of the UK.
Thank you. Building on that, obviously you're going to say very, but how important is export? I mean, in the current climate, and regardless of what the state of the business talent behind the creative talent is here, not just how important is it, but what opportunities are there?
Okay, if you look at the YouTube Music, the most recent statistics on export, which are far better sort of like stats than government producers, I think our latest exports of 2016, I think, were around £2.4 billion for music. Now, the two biggest generators of income for music, not just export, is publishing and live performance. So I would say in terms of export, again, going back to the earlier session about sync, you know, to make money in export, you've very much got to be looking to exploit those repertoire publishing opportunities through sync deals and through publishing, and also through live performance. And that's why we'll continue to support MEDS until 2020. We'll continue to support International Showcase Fund until 2020. And we're going to expand on our program of missions to emerging markets such as South Korea, China, and India, you know, some of which very much the main opportunities at the moment are very much on publishing and to a lesser extent on live performance. So export is very, very important for people's plans. I mean, if you look at streaming, obviously nowadays, bands and artists are instantly exportable. And you're not going to make money just by selling music to the UK market alone. Like I said, music's a global industry. If you're working with, you know, PRS for Music and your publishers, you know, you've got to be exploiting your repertoire internationally. And similarly through live performance, you know, through our schemes, we'll continue to support artists to build their campaigns across the world.
Thank you. I think we're being signaled to move to Q&A, which I'm going to do shortly. Although, as we're a wee bit late starting, I'm going to pinch a few more minutes. Jeff, export, from your point of view, is more about inbound in terms of attracting people to come to festivals and concerts. But do you see opportunity there, increasing opportunity or challenge there?
Yeah, well, you know, for us, obviously, we you know, when we're doing a festival, you want to attract people from outside of Scotland as well as, you know, local people to maximise the audience and maximise the attendance. You want to attract international artists as well, because that's really important to give you a standout, to make it work on television, to appeal to wider audiences, and to be an international event, you have to have an international programme. And I think if you're an artist, you've got to, you know, want to be, you know, going out and doing stuff, you know, outside of the UK as well, because the UK, you know, it's a limited market, so you want to be succeeding elsewhere as well. And, you know, it's interesting seeing things like Christine and the Queens, how well somebody singing in French language has done on the live scene, you know, and you know, it's a very popular artist, obviously being on Graham Norton massively helped. But, you know, so there you've got, you know, and not many, you know, I mean, going back to people like Manu Chao, there's not many, you know, French-speaking artists come in and make a success in the UK, because we're so terrible at languages ourselves. So I think export's very important for us. So it's about having a product that appeals outside of the local market, because then international artists want to play at it. And also it's important for us, for bands, say like a Biffy Clyro, for them to have an international standing. So otherwise it's very hard for us to get a band who might be big in Scotland, it's hard for us to have them high up on a bill and have artists play beneath them if they've never heard of them. And that's the day, I've been over to China and seen festivals there, and there'll be acts who are really, really huge in China, but they play like, you know, four or five slots down the bill, because all the Western acts are going, well, we've never heard of this act, we're not going to go on, you know, we want to go on after them. You know, so you know, it makes a lot of sense for a Scottish artist to have, you know, an international standing, because it actually helps them at home as well.
Thank you. Let's open it up. Any questions from the audience? Keith. Sorry, mate. Yeah.
Just pick up on the point with Creative Scotland and whether it builds infrastructure. Is the open project funding part of the part of what inhibits that growth, because it simply funds specific projects rather than building longer term infrastructure? And is there a need for that to change?
Yeah, I mean, one of our difficulties is that 90% of what we fund is reactive. It's what is coming to us as projects that then we can green light or not. We have a diminishing amount of strategic funds that I can go, there's a problem that needs to be solved over there, let's dip into that money and solve it. So the three routes that we have, the what we call the regular funding, which is the three-year cycle of 118 or so big organisations across all the cultural sectors, that's the government money. The Open Project Fund money is lottery money, so by its definition, we get that for the good of the Scottish people. It has to be that kind of thing. You can show that art is of benefit to everybody, but it has to have that function for us to be able to get it. So it becomes, therefore, more difficult to demonstrate that those infrastructure things, those research and development things sometimes are things that are more difficult to get through panels, through what are the open project guidelines. Now, what we are looking at is, if we have a funding review at some point, do we need to look at using some of the money that's coming into us somehow, and I don't think we'd be able to do this with the money that goes to open, but to have bigger strategic pots so that we can identify problems, whether it's literature looking at the state of Scottish publishing, or theatre looking at touring in the Highlands, or anything like that, all the music things that we see. But at the moment, the way the structure's set up, we don't have route to that. We have to wait till somebody applies to us with a roster of artists or something that they're wanting to develop as a manager, and we have to put it through a competitive process where they'll be up against visual artists and theatre shows and dance shows. But what myself and the team all have to do is, that's the situation, how can we work around those rules for the best benefit of the sector?
Thank you. That's the current situation, and a good provocative question there. Those of us who are not part of, you know, those of us in the private sector can lean on government to try and influence perhaps a shift in policy there. Another question, please. Suzanne.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Miller from CEO. A lot of events like this across all of the creative sectors, we've heard a lot of public sector organisations saying we need to start looking towards the private sector to bring more money into the creative sector. So I'd be interested, either in your professional point of view or your personal point of view, how do we create that infrastructure that attracts and brings that private sector money into the creative sector?
I actually think it's about not having obstacles. It's not always about what you can do to attract, it's what you do that gets in the way and shifting those out. I'll give a quick example. There's probably once a month there's a threat to either King Tut's, a Sub Club, or Barrowland from a development point of view of neighbouring buildings. Obviously, you know, in a moving forward city like Glasgow, the city wants to expand, it wants to get more hotels in. But the danger is that you bring in hotels and then the venues close down because they've not put noise protection in. There's and the Scottish Government has an opportunity next month, it's rewriting planning legislation, it can put in a thing called
agent of change.
It's a very simple principle that protects existing venues. Now, London are bringing that in. Wales have made it part of their legislation. Scotland can do it if the minister puts it in, because I think the other parties will support it as well. That if that goes in, it does protect the venues. And it's just it's things like that. And you know, Glasgow, from a planning point of view, if it looks at these planning applications and somebody advises a planning officer to go, you need a proper noise assessment in that planning application, because you know, otherwise 2 years down the line it could land up with Barrowland being closed or King Tut's being closed. And that isn't the intention of the developers. It just happens because they haven't put in the noise mitigation to protect the existing venue. And it's kind of recognising what are the crown jewels, you know. And if we don't have Barrowland, King Tut's, the sub club, we aren't going to get the tourists to come into the city to fill the hotels anyway, except for medical conferences. And we don't just want to be a city for medical conferences, we want to be a cultural city. We've got UNESCO City of Music status, we need to protect the venues. And it's dead easy to do, but at the moment, people are either not being proactive with legislation or not necessarily joining the dots between different departments. And if people do that, that makes it easier. So I think it's less about what can be done, it's more about stopping the blockages, you know, and that could be, you know, I could go on about bloody planning law and music festivals in rural areas, because, you know, but there's plenty of things that are out there that actually hinder you from operating, and not deliberately, you know, it's not people, you know, trying to stop culture and music happening, it's just people not realising where the blockages are. If you can knock down those walls, it'll be more attractive to everybody.
It's sometimes a lack of joined up thinking, isn't it?
Another question.
Oh, sorry, Neil, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah. I think a couple of positive examples that have happened. People remember there was a threat to close the club Fabric in London last year. After a very good campaign, Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, helped to sort of overturn that decision, and Fabric now remains open. The other thing as well was that the Met Police was imposing these quite tough guidelines on which was disproportionately affecting urban artists, particularly rhyme artists, to play gigs in London. Again, in the last 2 weeks, that's been overturned as well, that particular measure. And what was good from a government point of view was that Matt Hancock, who was a digital minister, was very proactive. People might even remember you went on Channel 4 News to talk about it. So I think I think at the moment, people can say bad things about the government, but I think we do have some very supportive ministers in the right places to support these decisions, because from the venues are particularly important to enable people to, you know, get the start in the business.
Those two examples you give as well are far better than just putting some cash investment into something as well, because actually it's letting those artists in that venue, you know, prosper by moving the things that are hindering it. So, you know, that's, you know, I think the fantastic examples.
Yeah, it's not always about money. It's about policy. It's about
approach and attitude.
Any more questions? Well, we are hanging about. I'm going to be straight down to the bar.
Just tell him what you want and he'll get in.
We could talk all day and night about this, but thank you very much for your attention and your contributions. And thank you very much to our panel. Just before we sign off fully, just very quickly from all four of you, can I just say, what would you like to see in the Scottish music business ecosystem? That what could we do to develop it? What elements would you like to see more of?
Many things. Let's pick one. Okay, I would quite like to see our own music expo office, because one of the things that we're doing pretty well in the last year at Creative Scotland is upping our presence at the at key international showcases and expos across each of the genres. So having our first Scottish stand at Jazz Ahead, our first Scottish stand at Classical Next, having a better networking presence at Great Escape, all these kind of things we're doing across all the genres. So we're showing off our music at all these places. People are getting booked for tours in Germany off the back of it, the next thing, and then they come to us for money to help with those tours, and they've got to go through the Open Project Fund. We need to back up this sense of showcasing our artists with a fund of money that then allows them to actually be able to tour the territories that they break.
Thank you. Good point. Jeff?
How do you follow that? I would just say I think a greater understanding of what, you know, from government, councils, etc., of what we do. And I think it's having that line of communication. And I don't quite know where it needs to be set up, but I think a more open communication, you know, and it's probably easier to do in Scotland than it, you know, because we are a smaller country and you do have more access to politicians and more access to government. If you want a meeting with the minister, you can generally, you know, try and get one. So I think, you know, that, and I think as an industry, we all need to talk to each other a lot more because we don't talk enough. And it's probably one of the failings of us as an industry is it inhibits collaboration and everything, because a lot of the problems we face are all similar, and probably there's people sitting there who could do something about it but don't actually know what. And in UK music, I think, you know, it's obviously, you know, does do a lot of that and has filled a big void that was there in the past. I remember Fergal Sharkey saying to us, you lot, you've all got, you know, none of you can pick your top three problems, you know, to be fixed. Because, and when once you do that, you'll probably find that two of them are the same for all sectors of industry. So get your act, you know, and that was, you know, before the setup of UK music, really. But so I think just, you know, greater communication amongst ourselves as an industry and with, you know, with government, with councils to enable just a sensible pathway for everybody's benefit, really.
Excellent, thank you. Rachel.
So building on what Alan and Jeff have just said, I would like to see much more appreciation, value and effort going into skills and development of the talent behind the talent. And I had a brilliant conversation many years ago with the then director of the New Zealand Tourist Board, and it's something that I've said often and I'll never forget it. And he said to me that when Scotland gets its shit together, we'll be really worried.
Thank you. Neil?
I think it's to be just bold and ambitious. I mean, I grew up listening to records from Fast Product and Postcard Records, fantastic independent labels from Scotland, producing some fantastic music. So we've always had that energy to go out there and do it. I think the power of networks, the collaboration, coming together as a network to share experience, to, you know, both domestic and international, you know, going, talking about some of the planning stuff, really coming together and really and working together, I think is critically important in Scotland. And also work with the rest of the creative industries. Just, again, we were looking earlier at music being sold into film and TV. I think there's quite a lot of synergy between music and digital and creative. And so not just think about music as being one single art form. Music is very much, in a lot of ways, integrated into wider creative. And I think try and bring that a little bit into play a bit more as well.
Brilliant, thank you. The reason I asked that is because that is a to-do list, not just for me, but for all of us to work together to achieve. But thank you very much.